Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1078. Surveillance Valley Part 4, Tore Up, subtitled Foxes Guarding the Online Privacy Hen House, Part 1. This is being recorded on July 9th of the year 2019. The title, the main part of the title of this series, is the title of a vitally important book called Surveillance Valley, subtitled The Secret Military History of the Internet, authored by Yasha, Y-A-S-H-A, Levine, capital L-E-V-I-N-E. As I have said before, I would not say this is the most important book I've ever read. I could not say that about any book I've ever read, but I will say without qualification this is as important a book as I have ever read. I will also state that for people living in this time, in this historical period, which is fundamentally dominated by the internet and related technologies, mobile phones, social media, etc., it would be, I think, impossible to fully understand the world you live in, to fully understand the civilization of which you are a part and of which we are all a part without understanding this book. It is vitally important, and I can't recommend it strongly enough. And again, I get no money whatsoever from this. We are going to be going into the book itself in the remaining portions of this program, and some of the key points of information, one of which we have already spoken about, some of the key points. In our last program, we spoke about the fact that the internet is not some beautiful device for communication. Yes, it does afford us access to a tremendous amount of information, and it is worldwide. The World Wide Web is indeed worldwide. But it is not intended, it was not intended in its inception to be some sort of boon for humankind. Far from it. The internet is a weapon. It is an information weapon, and it was developed as part of an overlapping series of DARPA projects. That is the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, now just the Advanced Research Project Agency, which was like the Pentagon's R&D wing. It was part of an overlapping series of DARPA projects, including Project Agile, that led to the development of, among other things, Agent Orange, the incredibly carcinogenic and mutagenic biological weapon, basically herbicide, that wreaked havoc not only on the landscape of Southeast Asia, but on the people who lived there and fought there, including the Vietnamese people themselves on both sides of the conflict, and American GIs as well, many of whom have succumbed to cancer or other forms of disease, and many of whose children have been beset with some horrible birth deformities. Again, the genesis of the internet and the genesis of Agent Orange are the same, and the raison d'etre, the purpose of both, is counterinsurgency, We spoke about the counterinsurgency genesis of the Nazi Party and of Adolf Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf. And in our last program, we took a look at the Cambridge Analytica affair as, in many ways, the embodiment of the political reality of the Internet. In this program, we are going to go into much of Yasha Levine's consummately important book. Some of the key points that we will be talking about. Again, the Internet is a weapon developed for counterinsurgency purposes. The big tech firms network with the very intelligence services that they publicly decry. In particular, in the wake of Eddie Snowden's operation, the various tech firms were going, this is terrible. How could this happen? Well, they network with the very intelligence services that they publicly decry. The big tech firms that data mine their customers on a nearly unimaginable scale do so as a direct operational extension of the very surveillance function upon which the Internet itself is predicated in a fundamental way. The technologies touted by the so-called privacy activists such as Edward Snowden and Jacob Applebaum, both of whom are tied to CIA in a fundamental way, technologies like the Tor Internet function and the Signal mobile phone app are readily accessible to the very intelligence services that they are supposed to deflect. In fact, they were pretty much developed by them and are marketed by them. The organizations that promote the alleged virtues of Snowden, Applebaum, Tor, Signal et al. Are linked to the very intelligence services that they would have us believe that they oppose. I would note that there may very well be many individuals in some of these organizations, like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who are sincere in their opposition to this. They may not know what is going on. Something that I have come to appreciate over the years is the fundamental truth of something that was pointed out by Upton Sinclair. It is very difficult to get someone to understand something when keeping their job depends on their not understanding that. You get people who are working for a progressive medium or for an ostensible civil liberties institution, and in fact those publications or media outlets or civil liberties institutions are compromised. This is their job. And I have come to appreciate, perhaps belatedly, that that has a lot to do with why we don't hear more about this. And really, it is understandable if you work for The Nation magazine or Pacifica Radio or the Electronic Frontier Foundation, all of which are compromised. Hell, it's your job. You know, it's how you pay your bills. It may very well be how you get your, or where you, from the source of your health insurance, etc. And there is an old vulgar expression, don't S blank, blank, blank where you eat. So that has a lot to do with it. And note also that the large tech firms embrace, quote, Internet freedom, unquote, as a distraction, from their own willful and all-embracing data mining and their ongoing conscious collaboration with the very intelligence services that they publicly decry. We are going to develop this in the remaining programs in this series. Note that We're going to cover much of Yasha Levine's a very important book in this series. However, the early parts of the book talk about the development of the Internet, and it has a military genesis. And Yasha Levine goes through the various projects and the various stages of development of the Internet, and the role that the military played in this. We are going to cover many of the individuals and many of the institutions involved with something that I think is the most important feature of the book, namely the fact that the things that were brought into the spotlight as a result of the Ed Snowden, quote, disclosures, unquote, and as I mentioned, as we covered in, for the record, 749, the last interview I did with John Loftus, 95% of what Snowden had to talk about, or what was contained in the documents that he leaked, was already on the public record. The Internet as an institution is fundamentally linked to, again, not only a surveillance function, but those who profess to be opposed to the surveillance function of the Internet are, in fact, deeply complicit with that. There are no doubt. Again, many individuals who are sincerely opposed to this, but the fundamental fact is that the tech firms, so many of the Internet privacy activists and organizations are actually compromised and are, in effect, double agents or intelligence fronts themselves.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
We're going to begin by taking a look at the Tor network. That is capital T-O-R. That is an Internet function that purports to give its users anonymity and freedom from the government surveillance that was, quote, disclosed, unquote. Note the quotes by Edward Snowden, the documents that Edward Snowden made public. Again, 95% of what Snowden talked about was already on the public record. The Tor network, however, was supposed to afford its users freedom from surveillance. It was purported to afford its users secrecy from surveillance. And in fact, it does no such thing. Not only is the Tor network itself something that was developed as part, it was basically developed by a DARPA and Navy project, but it is financed by the very intelligence services and the very government it supposedly shields its users from. The people touting Tor, people like Jacob Applebaum, about whom we will have more to say later, people like Eddie Snowden, institutions like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, are in fact deeply compromised. And we're going to get into that. We're going to talk about institutions like the Broadcasting Board of Governors, or BBG, and its Open Technology Fund, or OTF. Those are CIA derivatives, and we will get to that. However, beginning with the Tor network, again, T-O-R, is the spelling, and we are now going to begin reading from Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine. Then there was the fact that Signal ran on Amazon's, that is talking about the Signal Network. I'm getting ahead of myself here. Talking about the Tor Network. Levine writes, my problems began when I started digging into the Tor project. I investigated Tor's central role in the privacy movement after Edward Snowden presented the project as a panacea to surveillance on the Internet. I wasn't convinced, and it didn't take long to find a basis for my initial suspicions. The first red flag was Tor's Silicon Valley support. Privacy groups funded by companies like Google and Facebook, including the Electronic Frontier Foundation and Fight for the Future, were some of Tor's biggest and most dedicated backers. Google had directly bankrolled its development, paying out generous grants to college students who worked at Tor during their summer vacations. Why would an internet company whose entire business rested on tracking people online promote and help develop a powerful privacy tool? Something didn't add up. As I dug into the technical details of how Tor worked, I quickly realized that the Tor project offers no protection against the private tracking and profiling internet companies carry out. Tor works only if people are dedicated to maintaining a strict, anonymous internet routine, using only dummy email addresses and bogus accounts, carrying out all financial transactions in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, and never mentioning their real name in emails or messages. For the vast majority of people on the Internet, those who use Gmail, those who interact with Facebook friends and shop on Amazon, they reveal your identity. These companies know who you are. They know your name, your shipping address, your credit card information. They continue to scan your emails, map your social networks, and compile dossiers. Tor or not, once you enter your account name and password, Tor's anonymity technology becomes useless. Tor's ineffectiveness against Silicon Valley surveillance made it an odd program for Snowden and other privacy activists to embrace. After all, Snowden's leaked documents revealed that anything internet companies had, the NSA had as well. I was puzzled, but at least I understood why Tor had backing from Silicon Valley. It offered a false sense of privacy while not posing a threat to the industry's underlying surveillance model. Again, the all-encompassing data mining that all of these big tech companies do, and they're all in bed with the government, with NSA and others, is part and parcel to the very surveillance raison d'etre of the Internet in the first place. And if you can market technologies that purport to keep your information secret from all of those prying eyes, this serves as a wonderful foil. This last sentence again. I was puzzled, but at least I understood why Tor had backing from Silicon Valley. It offered a false sense of privacy while not posing a threat to the industry's underlying surveillance model. What wasn't clear, And what became apparent as I investigated Torah further was why the U.S. government supported it. A big part of Torah's mystique and appeal was that it was supposedly a fiercely independent and radical organization, an enemy of the state. Its official story was that it was funded by a wide variety of sources, which gave it total freedom to do whatever it wanted. But as I analyzed the organization's financial documents, I found that the opposite was true. Torah had come out of a joint U.S. Navy DARPA military project in the early 2000s and continued to rely on a series of federal contracts after it was spun off into a private nonprofit. This funding came from the Pentagon, the State Department, and at least one organization that derived from the CIA. These contracts added up to several million dollars a year, and most years accounted for more than 90% of Torah's operating budget. Torah was a federal military contractor. It even had its own federal contracting number. The deeper I went, the stranger it got. I learned that just about everyone involved in developing Torah was in some way tied up with the very state that they were supposed to be protecting people from. This included Torah's founder, Roger Dingledine, D-I-N-G-L-E-D-I-M-E, who spent a summer working at the NSA and who had brought Torah to life under a series of DARPA and Navy contracts. I even uncovered an old audio copy of a talk Dingledine gave in 2004, right as he was setting up Torah as an independent organization. Quote, "I contract for the United States government to build an anonymity technology for them and deploy it," unquote, he admitted at the time. And next, we're going to examine how the Torah network, far from frustrating intelligence surveillance, actually augments that very surveillance. Returning again to Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine. If Torah was truly the heart of the modern privacy movement and a real threat to the surveillance power of agencies like the NSA, why would the federal government, including the Pentagon, the parent of the NSA, continue to fund the organization? Why would the Pentagon support a technology that subverted its own power? It did not make sense. The documents in the box waiting on my doorstep contained the answer. By the way, these were documents that Yasha Levine obtained under the Freedom of Information Act. Returning to Surveillance Valley, combined with other information unearthed during my investigation, these documents showed that Torah, as well as the larger app-obsessed privacy movement that rallied around it after Snowden's NSA leaks, does not thwart the power of the U.S. government. It enhances it. The disclosures about Torah's inner workings I obtained from the Broadcasting Board of Governors have never been made public before. The story they tell is vital to our understanding of the Internet. They reveal that American military and intelligence interests are so deeply embedded in the fabric of the network that they dominate the very encryption tools and privacy organizations that are supposed to be in opposition to them. There is no escape. One more time. The documents in the box waiting on my doorstep contained the answer. Combined with other information unearthed during my investigation, they showed that Tor, as well as the larger app-obsessed privacy movement that rallied around it after Snowden's NSA leaks, does not thwart the power of the U.S. government. It enhances it. The disclosures about Tor's inner workings I obtained from the Broadcasting Board of Governors have never been made public before now. The story they tell is vital to our understanding of the Internet. They reveal that American military and intelligence interests are so deeply embedded in the fabric of the network that they dominate the very encryption tools and privacy organizations that are supposed to be in opposition to them. There is no escape.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Next, we're going to go into Tor and, among other things, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. In 2004, Roger Dingledine struck out on his own, spinning the military onion routing project Tor into a non-profit corporation called the Tor Project, and while still funded by DARPA and the Navy, began scratching around for private funding. He got help from an unexpected ally, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF, which gave Tor almost $250,000 to keep it going while Dingledine looked for other private sponsors. The Electronic Frontier Foundation even hosted Tor's website. To download the app, users had to browse to tor.eff.org, where they would see a reassuring message from the EFF. "Your traffic is safe when you use Tor," unquote. Announcing its support, the EFF sang Tor's praises, quote, "The Tor project is a perfect fit for EFF because one of our primary goals is to protect the privacy and anonymity of Internet users. Tor can help people exercise their First Amendment right to free, anonymous speech online." EFF's technology manager Chris Palmer explained in a 2004 press release, which curiously failed to mention that Tor was developed primarily for military intelligence use and was still actively funded by the Pentagon. One more time. Tor can help people exercise their First Amendment right to free, anonymous speech online, EFF's technology manager Chris Palmer explained in a 2004 press release, which curiously failed to mention that Tor was developed primarily for military intelligence use and was still actively funded by the Pentagon. Why would the EFF, a Silicon Valley advocacy group that positioned itself as a staunch critic of government surveillance programs, help sell a military intelligence communications tool to unsuspecting Internet users? Well, it was not as strange as it seems. EFF was only a decade old at the time, but it already had developed a history of working with law enforcement agencies and aiding the military. In 1994, EFF worked with the FBI to pass the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, which required all telecommunications companies to build their equipment so that it could be wiretapped by the FBI. In 1999, EFF worked to support NATO's bombing campaign in Kosovo with something called the Kosovo Privacy Support, which aimed to keep the region's internet access open during military action. Selling a Pentagon intelligence project as a grassroots privacy tool, it didn't seem all that wild. Indeed, in 2002, a few years before it funded Tor, EFF co-founder John Perry Barlow casually admitted that he had been consulting for intelligence agencies for a decade. It seemed that the worlds of soldiers, spies, and privacy were not as far apart as they appeared to be. EFF support for Tor was a big deal. The organization commanded respect in Silicon Valley and was widely seen as the ACLU of the Internet age. The fact that it backed Tor meant that no hard questions would be asked about the anonymity tool's military origins as it transitioned to the civilian world. One more time. The fact that the EFF backed Tor meant that no hard questions would be asked about the anonymity tool's military origins as it transitioned to the civilian world. And that is exactly what happened. I would interrupt. We have spoken about John Perry Barlow before. In addition to the fact that he worked closely with the CIA, he was a major lyricist for the Grateful Dead, the psychedelic rock band. He voted, by his own account, for white supremacist / segregationist George Wallace in 1968, something he described as a protest vote. One can but wonder what he was protesting. He is, in a sense, a link between the okey-doke, the neutralization of my generation, the much ballyhooed and incalculably overrated baby boomers, and the internet generation, the kids today, who just as the baby boomers were sold psychedelic drugs and that whole culture which neutralized them, today's young people are immersed in this technology which makes everything they do completely transparent to the government and to the intelligence services. At the end of this series, I'm going to muse about, or reflect about what the implications of this are for the average person, giving you a hint, I think, the cue as to how one should behave and the attitude one should have came from none other than Mahatma Gandhi, who was killed by the RSS, the parent organization of the BJP that is in power in India. But Gandhi, I think, really gave us the practical and moral footing that one should have in an age where, for all practical purposes, all communication and all culture are completely transparent to a government which, if it doesn't like what you are doing, can neutralize you or even kill you. Next, we're going to go into the BBG, the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Like the EFF, that is one of the organizations that backed the Tor network. And the BBG basically is a derivative of the CIA. It grew out of Radio Free Asia and Radio Free Europe, the CIA's broadcasting component. And really, when we hear about BBG or its Open Technology Fund, or OTF, think CIA. So when you hear BBG, as I read, think CIA. When you hear OTF, again, the Open Technology Fund, think CIA. returning again to Surveillance Valley. The BBG might have had a bland-sounding name and professed a noble mission to inform the world and spread democracy. In truth, the organization was an outgrowth of the Central Intelligence Agency. The bulk of the BBG is no longer funded from the CIA's black budget, but the agency's original Cold War goal and purpose, subversion and psychological operations directed against countries deemed hostile to U.S. interests, remain the same. The only thing that did change about the BBG is that today, more of its broadcasts are taking place online. And we're going to get into a bit of the history of Radio Free Europe and the CIA's broadcasting program. We did a long 25-hour series on the book Destiny Betrayed by Jim DiGiamio. That was published by Skyhorse Publishing. And in that series, we spoke about NBC and their broadcast in which Walter Sheridan, a longtime U.S. intelligence officer, basically did a hatchet job on Jim Garrison and his investigation. One of the things contained in that book is something of the history of NBC and its founder, General David Sarnoff, from Destiny Betrayed by Jim DiGiamio. And this, again, the background of Radio Free Europe and Radio Free Asia. Note how Radio Free Europe basically was a development of an expansion of Radio France, which was a Nazi broadcasting operation during World War II based in Paris, France, from Destiny Betrayed. It is relevant to note here that General David Sarnoff, founder of NBC, worked for the Signal Corps during World War II as a reserve officer. In 1944, Sarnoff worked for the complete restoration of the destroyed Radio France station in Paris until its signal was able to reach throughout Europe. And again, the Nazi Radio France station had been destroyed, but Sarnoff worked to restore it. He later lobbied the White House to expand the range and reach of Radio Free Europe. At about this point, Radio Free Europe became a pet project of Alan Dulles. Sarnoff's company, Radio Corporation of America, became a large part of the technological core of the NSA. During the war, David's son Robert worked in the broadcast arm of the Office of Strategic Services, or OSS, the forerunner of the CIA. Robert was president of RCA, NBC's parent company, at the time Sheridan's special aired. David was chairman. And I would note here that during World War II itself, Sarnoff's RCA was part of something called the Trans Radio Consortium, which, like so many of the major financial and industrial institutions on both sides of the Atlantic, was part of a cartel system which permitted the communication of vital intelligence to the Axis, which they used to great effect on the battlefield. The Trans Radio Consortium and RCA and David Sarnoff was discussed at some length in Trading with the Enemy, an expose of the Nazi American money plot by Charles Higham. In South America, Sosthenes Bane was in partnership as well as rivalry with an even more powerful organism, the giant Radio Corporation of America, which owned the NBC radio network. RCA was in partnership before and after Pearl Harbor with British Cable and Wireless, with Telefunken, the Nazi company, with Ital Cable, wholly owned by the Mussolini government, and with Vichy's Compagnie Générale in an organization known as the Trans Radio Consortium, with General Robert C. Davis, head of the New York chapter of the American Red Cross, as its chairman. In turn, RCA, British Cable and Wireless, and the German and Italian companies had a share with ITT in TTP, the Telegrafica e Telefonica del Plata, an access-controlled company providing telegraph and telephone service between Buenos Aires and Montevideo. Nazis in Montevideo could telephone Buenos Aires through TTP without coming under the control of either the state-owned system in Uruguay or the ITT system in Argentina. Messages, often dangerous to American security, were transmitted directly to Berlin and Rome by Transradio. Another shareholder was ITT's German, quote, rival, unquote, Siemens, which linked cables and networks with BAME south of Panama. The head of RCA during World War II was Colonel David Sarnoff, a stocky, square-set, determined man with a slow, subdued voice who came from Russia as an immigrant at the turn of the century and began as a newspaper seller, messenger boy, and Marconi wireless operator. After Pearl Harbor, Sarnoff cabled Roosevelt, quote, all of our facilities and personnel are ready and at your instant service. We await your command, unquote. Sarnoff played a crucial role, as crucial as Baines in the U.S. war effort, and like Bain, he was given a colonelcy in the U.S. Signal Corps. He solved complex problems, dealt with a maze of difficult requirements by the 12 million members of the U.S. Armed Forces, and coordinated details related to the Normandy landings. He prepared the whole printed and electronic press coverage of VJ Day in London in 1944 with headquarters at Claridge's Hotel. He was Eisenhower's inspired consultant and earned the Medal of Merit for his help in the occupation of Europe. Opening in 1943 with a chorus of praise from various generals, the new RCA laboratories had proved to be indispensable in time of war. But the public, which thought of Sarnoff as a pillar of patriotism, would have been astonished to learn of his partnership with the enemy through Transradio and TTP. The British public, beleaguered and bombed, would have been equally shocked to learn that British Cable and Wireless, 10% owned by the British government and under virtual government control in wartime, was in fact also in partnership with the Germans and Italians through the same companies and proxies. Simultaneously, the Transradio stations, according to State Department reports with the full knowledge of David Sarnoff, kept up a direct line to Berlin. The amount of intelligence passed along the lines can scarcely be calculated. The London office was in constant touch with New York throughout the war, sifting through reports from Argentina, Brazil, and Chile, and sending company reports to the Italian and German interests. The point here being that the Transradio Consortium, very much like many of the other institutions discussed in Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, basically were working both sides of the fence and permitted the transmission of vital intelligence to the Axis. And so basically, in effect, Sarnoff's milieu was working both sides of the street. Eventually, as we have looked at in past programs, Radio Free Europe relied heavily on some of the Eastern European fascists that were working for the Galen spy organization, and that ultimately became part of the Crusade for Freedom milieu, about which we have spoken so many times in the past.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Returning again to Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine of Radio Free Europe. In some cases, the stations, especially those targeting Ukraine, Germany, and the Baltic states, were staffed by known Nazi collaborators and broadcast anti-Semitic propaganda. Now, note again that BBG basically is a derivative of the CIA and the CIA's broadcasting programs, including Radio Free Europe, which was heavily linked to the Galen spy organization, and that was something of a child of Alan Dulles's, or a project of Alan Dulles's. The BBG also became a major backer of the Tor Project, along with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Returning now to Surveillance Valley. It was Wednesday morning, February 8th of 2006, when Roger Bingledine got the email he had been badly waiting for. The Broadcasting Board of Governors had finally agreed to back the Tor project. The Board of Governors, or BBG, seemed to offer a compromise. A large federal agency with close ties to the State Department, BBG ran America's foreign broadcasting operation, Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and Radio Free Asia. It was a government agency, so that wasn't ideal, but at least it had an altruistic sounding mission, quote, to inform, engage, and connect people around the world in support of freedom and democracy, unquote. Anyway, government or not, Dingledine didn't have much choice. Money was tight, and this seemed to be the best he could line up. So he said yes. It was a smart move. The initial $80,000 from the Broadcasting Board of Governors, or BBG, read CIA, was just the beginning. Within a year, the agency increased Tor's contract to $250,000 and then bumped it up again to almost $1 million just a few years later. The relationship also led to major contracts with other federal agencies, boosting Tor's meager operating budget to several million dollars a year. More about the Tor project here. Returning to Surveillance Valley, the correspondence left little room for doubt. The Tor project was not a radical indie organization fighting the man. For all intents and purposes, it was the man, or at least the man's right hand. Intermixed with updates on new hires, status reports, chatty suggestions for hikes and vacation spots, and the usual office banter, internal correspondence reveals Tor's close collaboration with the BBG and multiple other wings of the U.S. government, in particular those that dealt with foreign policy and soft power projection. Messages describe meetings, trainings and conferences with the NSA, CIA, FBI, and State Department. There are strategy sessions and discussions about the need to influence news coverage and control bad press. The correspondence also shows Tor employees taking orders from their handlers in the federal government, including plans to deploy their anonymity tool in countries deemed hostile to U.S. interests, China, Iran, Vietnam, and, of course, Russia. The funding record tells the story even more precisely. Tor was subsisting almost exclusively on government contracts. By 2008, that included contracts with DARPA, the Navy, the BBG, read CIA, and the State Department, as well as Stanford Research Institute's Cyber Threat Analytics Program. And next, we're going to go into a guy named Jacob Applebaum. That's Applebaum. He was at one point Julian Assange's right-hand man. He is the main American WikiLeaker. James Bamford has opined that Jacob Applebaum may very well have been the source for the shadow broker's leak of NSA tools with that crude Boris and Natasha Russian-accented English communications that they had. Certainly Jacob Applebaum is part and parcel to the very BBG, OTF, Tor network milieu that, as we have seen, and as Yasha Levine basically puts it here, the Tor project was not a radical indie organization fighting the man. For all intents and purposes, it was the man. So basically, is Jacob Applebaum. Turning to Jacob Applebaum, he was a devotee of Ayn Rand and her book, The Fountainhead. Ayn Rand is a major ideological fount for the right wing in this country. Mr. Ryan from the, formerly the Speaker of the House, was a big devotee of Ayn Rand. And she is a major, again, theoretical bulwark of the far right in this country. Of Jacob Applebaum and his infatuation with Ayn Rand's work. Like most young libertarians, he was enchanted by Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, which he described as one of his favorite books. Quote, I took up this book while I was traveling around Europe last year. Most of my super left-wing friends really dislike Ayn Rand for some reason or another. I cannot even begin to fathom why, but hey, to each their own, unquote, he wrote in his blog diary. While reading The Fountainhead, I felt like I was reading a story about people that I knew in my everyday life. The characters were simple. The story was simple. What I found compelling was the moral behind the story. I suppose it may be summed up in one line. Those that seek to gather you together for selfless actions wish to enslave you for their own game, unquote. And of Applebaum and Tor, Yasha Levine writes, in 2008, Applebaum finally got his dream job, a position that could expand with his giant ego and ambition. In April of that year, Dingeldine hired him as a full-time Tor contractor. He had a starting salary of $96,000 plus benefits and was put to work making Tor more user-friendly. Applebaum was a good coder, but he didn't stay focused on the technical side for long. As Dingeldine discovered, Applebaum proved better and much more useful at something else, branding and public relations, skipping down. Within months of getting the job for Tor, he assumed the role of official Tor Project spokesman and began promoting Tor as a powerful weapon against government oppression. Over the next several years, Dingelbein's reports back to the BBG, the CIA, were filled with descriptions of Applebaum's successful outreach. "Lots of Tor advocacy," wrote Dingelbein, again quoting, "another box of Tor stickers applied to many laptops. Lots of people were interested in Tor, and many people installed Tor on both laptops and servers." This advocacy resulted in at least 2 new high-bandwidth nodes that he helped the administrators configure, unquote. Internal documents show that the proposed budget for Dingelbein and Applebaum's global publicity program was $20,000 a year, which included a public relations strategy. Quote, "crafting a message that the media can understand is a critical piece of this," Dingelbein explained in a 2008 proposal. "This isn't so much about getting good press for Tor as it is about preparing journalists so if they see bad press and consider spreading it further, they will stop and think." And ultimately, Tor, BBG, Applebaum, etc., became hooked up with WikiLeaks. We'll take up more about this in our next program, but as something of a teaser and a bridge, Applebaum decided to attach himself to the WikiLeaks cause. He spent a few weeks with Julian Assange and the original WikiLeaks crew in Iceland as they prepared their first major release and helped secure the site's anonymous submissions system using Tor's hidden service feature, which hid the physical location of WikiLeaks servers and, in theory, made them much less susceptible to surveillance and attack. From then on, the WikiLeaks site proudly advertised Tor, quote, "secure, anonymous, distributed network for maximum security," unquote. Applebaum did his best to be Assange's right-hand man. He served as WikiLeaks' official American representative and bailed the founder of WikiLeaks out of tough spots when the heat from U.S. authorities got too hot. Applebaum became so intertwined with WikiLeaks that apparently some staffers talked about him leaving the organization if something were to happen to Assange. Assange gave Applebaum and Tor wide credit for helping WikiLeaks. Quote, "Jake has been a tireless promoter behind the scenes of our cause," Assange told the reporter. "Tor's importance to WikiLeaks cannot be underestimated." With those words, Applebaum and the Tor Project became central heroes in the WikiLeaks saga, right behind Assange. And of course, Tor, as Yasha Levine put it, if it wasn't the man, it was the man's right hand. In other words, the antithesis of what people have come to see WikiLeaks as being. We will go into WikiLeaks and Tor and Applebaum in our next program and review some of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange's many right-wing and fascist connections. However, this concludes For the Record program number 1078, Surveillance Valley Part 4, Tor Up, Fox's Guarding the Online Privacy Hen House Part 1. This is being recorded on July 9th of 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.